the Air Force's role in the first half of the Second World War is basically about launching these incredibly costly, complicated, massive missions against, first against Germany, then against Japan, where they send hundreds and hundreds of bombers and men to bomb targets deep inside Germany, and they don't hit them. They're missing everything. And it's like, so that, you know, that's the first crisis of the Second World War for these Air Force guys, which is, what do we do now that this idea that we'd hatched back in Alabama doesn't work?
Malcolm Gladwell, Outliers Blink, Talking to Strangers, and his newest book, The Bomber Mafia, which is an incredible look at the Air Force and the close of World War II. We'll talk with him next. It's the Ryan Russillo podcast presented by FanDuel. Take a shot at betting the NBA with FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook. Right now, you can check out the new and improved Parlay Hub. Filter by odds, sport, and bet type to easily find the most popular parlays and same-game parlays all on one page. Plus, start betting the Explore page and the Pulse and bet live same-game parlays for every NBA game. So download the app today and bet with FanDuel, official partner of the NBA. The Ringer is committed to responsible gaming. Please visit rg-help.com to learn more about the resources and helplines available. And listen to the end of the episode for additional details. Must be 21 and older and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit rg-help.com. This episode is brought to you by Arby's. I remember my first visit to Arby's. I went with my grandfather, fresh out of WWII. I reached for his hand. He declined my grasp. I was worried about the options. I said, I know they dominate the roast beef world, but is there going to be anything for me? And here's the thing. There is. Well, now is the chance to try Arby's and find your favorite sandwich. With a wide range of options, see for yourself that Arby's sells more than roast beef. Plus, for a limited time, Arby's Rewards members get one free sandwich with purchase every week in April, online only. Simply join Arby's Rewards and order ahead today. Order on the app or Arby's.com. This is a real thrill. Somebody who I've been reading for years, I know a lot of our listeners as well, the great Malcolm Gladwell. His most recent book, The Bomber Mafia, anybody that likes war history, and he kind of shares with us his passion for it. So let's kind of start. There's a bunch of different ways I could start this. I thought about it last night, but let's start with kind of a better understanding of what the Air Force was, where it was in its standing, who was actually in control of it, and how it kind of started to deviate from the normal process of where its kind of hierarchy was in the middle, in the military.
So this is a book about this moment in the history of the Air Force. The Air Force is, at the beginning of the Second World War, through the Second World War, is part of the Army. And it's because the airplane is so new. It's like it's this brand new technology that no one particularly understands. And the Army is run by these guys who think it's just a toy. And there's a group of young men who call themselves the Bomber Mafia who are in love with this technology. And they're at some Army base in Virginia, and they have to do, among other things, cavalry training. They have to train on horses and like muck out the stables. And they're literally like, what the fuck? We're obsessed with the technology that will literally the most important technological revolution of the 20th century, or one of them. And you're making me, train on a horse every morning. And so they decide to leave and go to Montgomery, Alabama, to Maxwell Air Force Base, because they want to get as far away as possible from the Army brass in and around Washington. And it's the middle of it's still kind of the middle. I don't want to diss Montgomery, but I've been there many times. It's still not, it's not Paris. But in 1935, it's like such a backwater, because they want to be as far away as possible. And they start this kind of internal revolution. And they famously say, if the guys back, the Army brass back in Washington knew what we were doing down here in Alabama, they would fire us all. Because these guys think that the airplane is all that matters, and that they're going to render every single part of modern warfare obsolete. And so there's like 10 of these guys, and it's this crazy like insurgency within the Army on the eve of the Second World War. And so my book is a story about what happens to these guys when they bring their insurgency into real combat. And more generally, though, it's about this idea of dreamers, about what is the place of people who get obsessed with some new and bold and crazy idea, and what happens when that idea confronts the establishment. And it's, you know, it's one of the kind of oldest and grandest narratives of all, right? Is the newcomer confronts the old guard. And it has so much kind of, I felt in writing this book that I, you know, it feels so contemporary too, like, because we see versions of this conflict now in the present day, you know, everywhere we look. And so I don't know, it was a really, really, really cool story to tell.
What I like about this, and it's a theme at times where, you know, you do challenge things and then you'll try to get us to think about something a little bit differently. But this is a little bit more, you know, pragmatic in the sense is like, hey, this is the way we do things. This is how we send out bombing missions. And this is what we do. This is a formation. This is the altitude. This is the you know, trying to calculate risk. And you make it's not even a compelling point. You basically blast through, and the people at the time from the bomber mafia were like, wait a minute, why are we doing it this way? Can you run through some of the calculations and realizing, like, these bomber missions that we would read about and how successful they were incredibly inefficient.
Yes.
And it was based on assumptions, and the assumptions never being challenged. And I think that's kind of one of the core things from this book, is that this group, this bomber mafia, were like, well, wait a minute. Like, if we keep, like, what are the numbers? And they'd have these bombing missions of World War II into Germany where, actually, when you look back at the numbers, they were astonishingly terrible. Like, and people would, but then they would write up reports as if they were overwhelmingly successful, and the math was so off.
Yeah, so the basic problem is a physics problem. So you have the bomber mafia are obsessed with bombers, bombers are brand new in the 30s. This idea that you can build a plane that's really big, powerful, that can fly really, really high and really, really fast. And their idea was bombers were so powerful and large and fast that no fighter plane could ever catch them, shoot them down. They were going to be impervious to any kind of, no anti-aircraft missile could ever bring them down. They could not be stopped. And so they said, oh, if the bomber can't be stopped, then it can win the war all by itself. But the only way for that dream to work is if the bomb that you drop from 25,000 feet can hit its target. And the bomber mafia assume they can figure that problem out. And they have they develop this incredibly complex and expensive analog computer called the Norden Bombsight, which they believe will allow them they could be going 250 miles an hour at 25,000 feet, and they can drop one bomb and they're aiming on a bridge and they'll be able to hit the bridge. That's their assumption. But they run into the problem, which is that actually it's really, really hard. Solving the physics problem of how to drop a bomb from 25,000 feet when you're going 250 miles an hour and there's a wind blowing and there's temperature change and there's clouds, you know, obscuring the target and all, turns out to be an almost impossible problem to solve from the 1940s, using 1940s technology. To use a sports analogy, you know, the really simple version of this, you would think that a world-class athlete standing at the foul line, shooting a foul shot without anyone's hands in their face, with, you know, you should be able to do that with 95% accuracy, right? But you can't. In fact, there are some people who can't even do it with 50% accuracy. People who are making millions of dollars a year. It's a physics problem. You have to have a reproducible motion. You have to put a very large ball in a very small. So that the physics problem of dropping a bomb from 25,000 feet is 1,000 times more complicated than that. And human beings tend to think these accuracy problems are a lot easier than they are. And so the bomber mafia, the first problem they have in the Second World War is they can't do what they dreamt of doing back in Alabama. They can't hit anything. And so the Air Force's role in the first half of the Second World War is basically about launching these incredibly costly, complicated, massive missions against first against Germany, then against Japan, where they send hundreds and hundreds of bombers and men to bomb targets deep inside Germany, and they don't hit them. They're missing everything. And it's like, so that, you know, that's the first crisis of the Second World War for these Air Force guys, which is, what do we do now that this idea that we'd hatched back in Alabama doesn't work? What do you do when you can't hit anything, right? You have to change strategy. And so that's the second half of the book is devoted to, well, what is the strategy they choose when option one doesn't work? And that second strategy is deeply morally problematic.
Right. And I want to get to that because that kind of is where you intro us into Curtis LeMay and Haywood Hansel. Why don't you give me a little backstory of both of them and then how that ultimately leads to the decision in Guam, which starts basically the second half of World War II.
Yeah. So the book is really a story about two men who are, they hate each other. That's the first thing that should be said, because they represent different sides in this debate about how should we conduct bombing campaigns in the Second World War. The first guy is Haywood Hansel, there are these group of guys down in Maxwell, and he's one of the ringleaders of this group. And Hansel, they're all young, these guys. They're all in their 20s and 30s. They are obsessed with the promise of military aviation. They are, you know, Hansel is one of those guys who does one of the first forms of those acrobatic flyers. He's the guy who does tricks in the air, and he's a brilliant pilot. He's a dreamer. He's a poet. When he's coming back from bombing missions over Europe, and is, you know, you've got a plane full of guys who have just seen their life pass before their eyes, and they're 19 years old, and they're scared out of their minds. He would sing them Broadway show tunes to calm them down. I mean, he's handsome. He's from a long Southern family of military. You know, his great grandfather is like a Confederate general. He has like the scarf around his neck. He's just this kind of like. My favorite story about Haywood Hansel is these guys work all the time. They are never home. He is a baby at home. He finally goes to see his wife and the baby. Like, he hasn't been home for months. And in the middle of dinner, he hears sound. He turns to his wife and says, "What's that sound?" She goes, "That's your son. He's crying." He doesn't even know what his baby sounds like. He's like, these guys are like, they're so, this is so not possible in 2021 to live the kind of life these guys lead. And by the way, this is a point when his wife is in Northern Virginia and he's been detailed to Washington, D.C. for a few months. He doesn't even go and see his family, and he's like 2 miles away. Like, these guys are just like, it's just another, it is our grandparents' generation. It is so not ours. So he's one side of the argument, and he thinks he's a dreamer. He's Elon Musk. He's like the kind of like romantic version of Elon Musk. He just thinks that he's in love with what technology can promise. Curtis LeMay is the opposite. Curtis LeMay is this kind of working class guy from Columbus, Ohio, who puts himself through Ohio State, whose family is like got an alcoholic dad who's never there. He's got like 8 siblings, and he's the eldest. He's the provider. He never says, he's this guy, he always has a cigar in his mouth. He's famously the most taciturn. In fact, there's a famous story about years later when he's head of the Air Force, he gets briefed before the Bay of Pigs, you know, the famous botched invasion of Cuba that Kennedy launches in 1962, 61. And LeMay's in the room for the briefing, and it goes on for like hours. He doesn't say a word. At the end, he gets up, takes his cigar out of his mouth, and just says, "Won't work," and leaves. That's the kind of guy he is. He's like this. He looks like he looks like a linebacker. He's got like a square head and a big barrel chest. And he is brutal, and he is bloodthirsty, and he is he's a genius. He's maybe the greatest combat commander, one of the greatest combat commanders of the Second World War. And people are terrified of him. And he becomes convinced that everything the Bomber Mafia is saying and doing is a pile of horseshit. He just has no time for it. And they involve him in one of their earliest, most disastrous campaigns, this bombing attack on Schweinfurt. And it just, he becomes convinced that if these guys continue to run the air war, we're going to lose to the Nazis and to the Japanese. And so there's a kind of blood feud that develops between Hansel and Curtis LeMay. And that's my book is a kind of the emotional center of the book is the conflict between these two incredibly disparate guys.
It is weird reading stories like this in today's day, because you read about LeMay and you're like, okay, well, this guy one of his nicknames is the Demon, but you go, okay, is this, I mean, I'm not getting into like, hey, is this problematic? Countries are trying to win a war here, right? They're trying to prevent Nazi Germany from expanding. So this isn't something that, you know, in today's day and age, you never know how people talk about things, but he had one mission, and that was to end this thing as quickly as possible. And I think there's a part of it where you could describe him as this bad person because he was so bad, but at the same time, like, his rationalization for things actually led to him wanting things to be more as civil, which I know sounds crazy, but that's kind of one of the points of the book that I think really brings it together. Because, I mean, he's somebody too that would be like, look, this is what we're going to do. We're going to fly to lower altitude and I'm going to be in the front. And if you guys abort, then you're going to get court-martialed. Like, it was to the point where these bombers were going in these raids and guys were just peeling off left and right. And then when he says, no, we're done with that. And by the way, I'll be in the front and I'm going to lead every single mission. So for anyone that has any military background whatsoever, the admiration that you have for him, as vicious as the outcome had to be for the war to end the way it did, there's a lot to be said about just a level of respect that you would have for somebody that would say, okay, and I'll be in the front plane, which is, I think, why there's so much respect for him.
Yeah, so this is actually a fascinating little... What was happening in the early days of the Second World War is that guys would go on bombing missions, and you'd go into your final approach to the target, and you want to get relatively low to maximize your chances of hitting the target. And what would happen is that you've got some 20-year-old kid from wherever, Kansas, whatever. He's probably been on, you know, a year ago he was in high school, and he's piloting one of these planes, and they would get scared, understandably. There would be enemy fighters coming at them and anti-aircraft fire from the ground. And what would happen is, just at the moment when they should have been lining up the target, they would get scared and they would do evasive maneuvers. They'd basically just start moving the plane all around, trying to dodge the fire. And finally, sometimes they would just peel away and just drop the bombs wherever they wanted to drop them. And so that the whole thing would be a waste. So an incredible amount of time and energy was wasted in these bombing runs, because guys just weren't dropping their bombs on a target. And LeMay, in classic LeMay fashion, just says, this has to end. That we're going to go steady, fly steady and straight towards the target, regardless of how much anti-aircraft fire is and regardless of how much enemy fighter activity there is. And I am going to lead the first one of these, you know, what sounds like a suicide mission. It's not a suicide mission. I'll show you why. And I'll be in the front of this, of the attack. And if anyone, if anyone doesn't follow my lead and fly steady and straight towards the target, I will court-martial your ass, right? It's like they begin to realize that it's not as suicidal in practice as it sounded in theory. And he convinces people that you can actually fly steady and straight towards the target and you won't, your chances of getting shot down by the enemy are not greater. But he had, this is a guy with, I mean, an insane amount of almost reckless courage. And anyone who flew with him, who served under him, just had an incredible amount of respect for him. I mean, to the point where I talked to some people who, you know, these 90-year-old retired Air Force guys who knew LeMay back in the day. And if hypothetically LeMay had walked in the room, they would have dropped everything and saluted him and followed him wherever he said, we're going to Afghanistan and we're going to, they would go. Like, it's that kind of, the you know, that rare kind of it almost seems like, I don't know whether anyone does this anymore, like that kind of loyalty people would have to a leader, where you would be, you'd be willing to put aside all considerations of your own safety for whatever cause the leader says is the right one. You know, Martin Luther King was that kind of person. You know, there are coaches, old school. I'm sure John Wooden was that kind of person. You know, you could find these people, but they're the number of people who can, who are capable of inspiring people to follow them in that way is really small. I mean, it's vanishingly small.
This episode is supported by State Farm. So look, a little rock hit your dude's windshield on the highway. And at first you're like, what is that? I'm like, oh, it's just a little mark. Nope. Now by the end of the ride, it's a big crack. And it'd been a while. So I check out the State Farm app. I go, hey, this is what happened. And the funny thing is I was like, do I want to go app first or do I call? Old school guy, probably should call. I was like, let's check out the app. Not only did it take a minute to get done, they set up the glass replacement. They told me the estimate ahead of time, said, you want to go ahead with it? And I was like, now I understand. It's all in front of me, all done. I don't even have to talk to anybody. That's how efficient the insurance game has become. But really, the only words you need to remember are, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. State Farm has options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, just like I did, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to somebody. The app was so good, I didn't even need to do that. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Learn more at statefarm.com. This episode is brought to you by Hulu Plus Live TV. Looking for a better way to watch live TV? Stream your favorite sports and shows on over 95 live channels with Hulu Plus Live TV. Get access to Hulu's entire streaming library, Disney Plus and ESPN Plus, all in one plan. Start your free trial of Hulu Plus Live TV today. Live TV plan required. Restrictions apply. Access content from each service separately. Learn more at Hulu.com.
I don't know how much you want to get into with the challenges of attacking Japan, because like I'm reading those chapters going, you've got these guys going up and they're coming back and reporting tailwind speeds that people back on base think they're lying about. You have the Himalaya path where the amount of gas it would take to deliver gas was like four times as much just getting over these mountain ranges. Mm-hmm. And all of these problems were with Haywood Hansel in charge ultimately leads to the government saying, all right, like it's over. We're putting in LeMay. Give us some of the background and all this stuff, because it's just, sometimes you can forget that even though it's only 60 something years ago, you know, that it can be not that long ago and forever ago all at the same time. Because reading the reactions to these failed missions over Japan, you'd be like, wait a minute. So how could you guys not understand it? It's like, no, people just didn't. They didn't understand the jet stream then.
Yeah. So the war against Japan is a poses this massive geographical problem, which is Japan is really, really, really far away. And we don't have planes that can fly, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of miles. So the question is, the only way we can get Japan to surrender, it's an island nation, is we want to bomb them. How do you bomb them if you can't reach them? So the first way we solve this problem is in 1944, there's an incredibly brutal set of battles in the South Pacific, for the Mariana Islands, for Guam, Saipan, and Tinian. Some of the most brutal fighting of the war. The Marines take those three islands. And the reason, these are little volcanic specks in the middle of the Pacific. The only reason we spend weeks and weeks and sacrifice thousands of lives to seize these islands is that if we control the Marianas, we can reach Japan. It's within the range of a B-29 bomber, which is a huge, huge, huge deal. It's just within the range. I mean, when I say just, I mean like if you miscalculate even by a little, you will fall into the ocean short when you're coming home because you're run out of fuel. So we seize the Marianas and we set up these. They built three of the biggest airports in the world on these three little volcanic islands. And we start to launch attacks on Japan. And it sounds like it's going to be pretty straightforward. And that's when Heywood Hansell comes in with his bomber mafia ideas and says, we can do precision bombing against Japan from the Mariana Islands. And it doesn't work out that way. And the second half of my book is all about the unexpected problems that you face when you're trying to attack Japan with pretty primitive technology, and you run into something, among other things, things you've never heard of or thought of before. One of them is the jet stream, that if you're flying at 25,000 feet over Japan, there are winds that are so powerful that they will mess with everything you're doing. There's all kinds of other issues that they run into. And what happens ultimately is the failure of the bomber mafia in bringing the fight against Japan in 1944 leads to Heywood Hansell being replaced with Curtis LeMay. That these two antagonists, these guys who hate each other, one guy gets fired, and the new guy, they kick out the dreamer and they bring in basically Woody Hayes,
which is a perfect way of putting it. Yeah.
Curtis LeMay. I mean, even both of them are both Ohio State guys. I mean, it's like perfect. They kind of look the same. And that's the bloodiest and the most kind of brutal chapter of the Second World War is what Curtis LeMay does to Japan in the summer of 1945. It's like, what happens when you bring in the guy who has no illusions whatsoever, no grand attachment to technologies, no commitment to fighting a kind of clean and perfect war? What happens when you bring in the complete pragmatist whose only goal is to win the war as quickly and as efficiently and as savagely as possible? And that is a legacy we've been living with for the last 75 years.
Yeah, I was trying to think of like the equivalent of Hansel then, if he's Woody Hayes. And I was thinking like Mark Trestman, the Bears brought him in from Montreal to be like, all right, we're going to do this. And then people were like, I love this. This is outside the box, until they didn't love it anymore. I had no idea the first napalm bomb was set off on Harvard's campus.
A Boston guy. As a Boston guy or a New England guy, napalm, the weirdest part of reporting this book was this whole thing. I thought that napalm was a Vietnam War invention. It's not. It was invented at Harvard during the Second World War explicitly to be used against Japan. Because Japanese cities were made out of wood and the houses were really close together and there were very few parks and they were tinderboxes. And so the army was like, wait a second, you don't want to use a conventional explosive against cities that are made of wood. Let's use an incendiary. You want to burn them down. You don't want to blow them up. And so they bring in all the fire guys. There's a whole cadre of people who are experts in fire, and they say, build us the greatest incendiary bomb ever, something that can burn anything down. And so a bunch of this brilliant Harvard chemist comes up with this idea of basically making a jellied form of gasoline that you put inside of a canister, you drop the canister, and you have these globs of jellied gasoline that will explode and attach themselves to whatever surface they land on. And it will burn, the thing he comes up with burns hotter and faster than any incendiary weapon that had ever been created before. And that's napalm. Napalm is an insanely effective and brutal weapon. It burns everything it touches. And they use it. Hansel gets kicked out and because he can't hit anything in his when trying to bomb Japan. They bring in LeMay, and LeMay says, you know what? Fuck it. I'm going to napalm the entire country of Japan. And that's what he does in the summer of 1945. He napalms 66 Japanese cities. He essentially burns the country to the ground. And that's the climax of the book. And it is the most kind of overlooked bit of American, recent American history, between that and, well, yes, it is. I think it is one of the most overlooked bits of American history. This incredibly savage reign of fire that Curtis LeMay visits on Japan in the summer of 45, where he probably kills close to 1 million Japanese civilians in one summer. 1 million civilians in the space of 2.5 months.
And this is before the two atomic bombs, which wait, are you serious? As you go through the numbers. Now, as we finish the conversation, the thing that no one expects when you're reading the book and aren't going to expect, why did Japan honor him almost 20 years later?
It's one of the great, I mean, it's one of the great mysteries. LeMay is given in the 1960s. 1950s or 60s, the highest honor Japan can bestow upon a non-Japanese person. And it's said to be because of his help in rebuilding the Japanese Air Force after the war, which he does do. He does come to, goes back to Japan after reducing Japan to ashes in the summer of 45 and killing more Japanese than any person in human history. He is invited back to help them rebuild their Air Force, and he does it and does such a good job that they give him a prize. The Japanese were determined to put their experience and their memories of the Second World War behind them. I mean, I think it's the best way I can describe it. Even to this day, you know, the only memorial in Japan to the firebombing of Tokyo in the summer of 45 is a little private museum that some random guy built, not even a government museum. I mean, it's you are hard pressed to find any kind of public discussion or mention of the firebombing of Japan in Japan today, in contemporary Japan today. It's just a different cultural attitude towards historical tragedy. I mean, this country is a very different approach. You know, we very aggressively memorialize things. I did a podcast episode last year on the 9/11 memorial. I mean, we spent billions of dollars memorializing 9/11. That's not the way that other cultures do it.
I have a bigger question for you. I really enjoyed Talking to Strangers, The Default to Truth. And I started thinking about the process of that. And I mean, you explain it pretty frankly in that if we decided to go another way, we wouldn't get a lot done once we get out the door. Mm-hmm. But in all the ways you've looked at, you know, our society and then societies throughout the world, are you more impressed with things that we've done or more disappointed?
When you say we, you mean
people.
People.
Yeah.
More impressed. I mean, I'm ultimately an optimist, and I'm aware, and I am, you know, very much aware of how we have it better than in any other generation in history and any other. So it's like, it's very hard for me not to be, and I'm in awe of some of the institutions that we've created. I mean, one of the things, reasons, just to go back briefly to the book, I didn't know a lot about the Air Force, and I came away from writing my book just blown away by the Air Force. Man, what an amazing institution that is. And the people I met in the Air Force were, you know, some of the most impressive group of people I've ever encountered in my life, who have devoted their lives to the defense of the United States, and, you know, who make, I don't know what they make. They don't make what they could make in the private sector, that's for sure. And I don't know. I just think the idea, and it's funny, I've told the story before, but in the middle of last summer, you know, there was a moment last summer where things were as crazy as they will maybe ever be, you know, middle of Trump craziness, election craziness, COVID craziness. It really seemed like the world was going to hell in a handbasket. And the Air Force had a changeover from the old chief of staff to the new guy, General Brown, from General Goldfein to General Brown. And I watched it on, it was a live stream of the changeover ceremony. And it was so dignified, so thoughtful, so emotionally moving. A series of people stood up and gave these speeches, isn't the right word. They spoke in a moving way about this country, about the Air Force, about what the guy leaving the post was all about and who the guy coming in was all about and what their families were like. And it was also fascinating. The new chief of staff of the Air Force is an African-American. The secretary of the Air Force at that point was a woman. The outgoing secretary of the Air Force was a woman. It was just like a different America. And in the middle of all of this crazy dysfunction of last summer, I just got a glimpse of like this institution that was more than thriving. It was like, it represented all of America. It was a true meritocracy. It was in the middle of the craziness. It was having a peaceful transition of power. The head of the Joint Chiefs, this guy, General Milley, I don't know if you've ever, gave this speech that was like, if any politician running for higher office in this country gave a speech half as good as his speech, they would win in the landslide. It's like this guy, like 90% of Americans don't know the name of the person who runs the Joint Chiefs of Staff. That guy is a funny, incredibly intelligent, unbelievably charismatic. He's a dude who I would follow into combat. It's like, and you just realize the rest of the world may be falling apart, but there are parts of this country that are really, really strong and powerful. And, you know, they will be around for a long time. And it just made me, I wept at the end of watching this. I was just like, you know, and I was so much more optimistic after it was over than I was going in. And I've carried that optimism with me ever since. Like, it's so easy to get convinced by the dysfunction of a few small areas of this country into thinking the dysfunction's everywhere. It's not. You know, it's just not. It's like most things in this country work really well.
I was lucky enough to be invited to the Air Force campus in Colorado, and you nailed it. The description, it's inspiring, makes you feel like in a way inadequate, but not in a way where you're driving away depressed
from
the place.
All right. Of those kids at the Air Force Academy are so much smarter than you are. And me.
And so, yeah, you look around and, you know, there's, I don't know if it sounds cheesy or outdated, but it's how I felt, like this call to service that you go, all right, you know, but there's, I love the book, man. So I don't want to share too much more of it, even though we already have, but I think people are going to really enjoy, because there's so many little details. There's more LeMay stuff in there, at the end, especially when you just start to kind of paint a picture of who he is as a man, you know, when you go to his house, and hear these stories. But the last thing I wanted to ask you about, because I'm an avid listener as well, the Revisionist History, you get season 6 out now. This is amazing, because this was like one of those things that we would go to, the U.S. News and World Report college rankings. Uh-huh. And I mean, talk about having a guest dead to rights about the reputation score. And so if you could kind of share, like, uh-huh, it was, you knew you had him, you were nice about it in the most clear way you could be. But this was a big deal. Like, people love to rank stuff. We love to read rankings. When I'm applying to colleges, I'm looking at them all in the bookstore being like, okay, you know, could I get this one? Yeah. You know, where's my school ranked now? And then you're like, wait a minute, what happened? But this whole thing was basically, like, at the extremes, it made sense. But the voting process was totally out of control, outdated, criminal. And yet the denial in the interview was hilarious, because the guy seemed like a nice enough guy, but you were just like, this doesn't make any sense, sir. And he was like, well, and he was trying to find ways to shave off some of the facts. It just wasn't very convincing. So whatever direction you want to go, because I thought that was really funny. And I had, you know, no one had really done a deep dive on it before. So I enjoyed it.
One of my favorite things in revisionist history over the years has been, you know, I love going after American higher ed, which I think is just such, so full of nonsense. And I had, years ago, I interviewed the president of Stanford. And I was asking him about his endowment, because Stanford's got, what, $25 billion in the bank. And I asked him a very simple question, which is, would he ever consider giving any of that money to a school that didn't have a big endowment? And he's just like, his head exploded. It was so hilarious. Anyway, I had a similar moment with this one. The U.S. News rankings, the most important, people don't realize this, the most important variable in their algorithm determines how they rank you. It's what they call a reputation score. And the reputation score is generated by asking all of the college presidents in the country to rank every other school in the country on a scale of 1 to 5. So right away, we're in high comedy territory because, like, so how would you know, right? My big point, which I raised with the guy who runs the U.S. News rankings, I was like, you know, if I gave them, I gave them the examples of a Jesuit school, Gonzaga, an Orthodox Jewish school, yeshiva, and a Mormon school, Brigham Young. So we're asking the president of Brigham Young to rank yeshiva on a scale of 1 to 5. Has the president of Brigham Young ever been to yeshiva? Do they know anything about Orthodox Jewish whatever? Similarly, we're asking the head of yeshiva to rank Gonzaga. What? Why would he give a Jesuit school a good score? He's like opposed to the Jesuits, right? I mean, it's the ludicrousness. It goes on and on and on. And not on that.
So I could just see the guy being like, oh, put a 3 next to him.
Yeah, that's right. It's like, and you talk, I started calling up college presidents, and I would say, how do you, there's 300 colleges on this list, and you're asked to rank them. Do you know anything about these schools? And they're like, no, I don't know anything about it. And, like, you know, and then one guy I talked to, in order to get people to know his school better, he makes his own hot sauce, and he would send hot sauce to all the other college presidents to get them to vote for his school. Like, it's this crazy thing. But anyway, I got the guy who runs the U.S. News rankings, and I just sort of walking him through the absurdity of this reputation score system. And it was a situation where he knows it's bullshit, but his job depends on him pretending that it's not bullshit. And it was kind of painful and hilarious at the same time. But and it was a reminder, there are a class of people in this country who are in that very unenviable position where they are required to defend the defenseless. You know, you know in your heart, it's like being, imagine being.
It's like working for the NCAA, basically.
It's like working for the NCAA. It is exactly like that. Or being the press officer to Marjorie Taylor Greene. It's like, at a certain point, you're like, oh man, life's too short. Do I really have to, like, go on about QAnon today, or do I have to pretend an amateurism for one more?
The
NCAA is the only other major American institution that is as aggressively stupid as the U.S. News rankings. I don't know. I have these fantasies about what would be the simplest fix for the NCAA, and I think it's moving them. Does it really matter where you move them? Which they're all, because they're in Kansas City.
Were you arguing like a change of scenery? So like a trade at the baseball deadline where you just get a reliever in a new city and we just expect it's going to
exactly
be better?
It's exactly what it is. It's like Lonzo Ball needs a new change of scenery. But they all live in, like, they're in like Overland Park or something in Kansas City. I know a little bit about Kansas City. The thing about Kansas City is I know where they all live. They all live in the Country Club District. Kansas City is a beautiful place to live. You can live, you have a really high standard of living. You send your kids to first class public schools. You're in a bubble. You're in a middle America bubble, right? And your notion of what's going on in, like, all of these colleges that you're ruling over all around the country is so minimal. They got to force them out. Let's move them to, like, the west side of Philadelphia. Let's move them to Rochester. Let's make them suffer through an upstate New York winter. Let's move them to Northern California where they can't afford to live anywhere and there's a wildfire every 2 years. Just do something to shake them up and alert them to the complexities of the world. But that little part of people, that they're just not in real America.
Right.
Suburban,
okay, but
Kansas City.
Isn't it Indy though? Is it Indianapolis or is there another location?
I thought they're in Kansas City. They're in Overland Park.
Okay. Well, because I know that there's some of it's located in Indy.
Yeah.
So you want to de-Bristolize them, is what you're saying.
I want to
take East. Yes.
ESPN would be another. I remember going to the ESPN campus for the first time.
When did you go? What were you promoting?
I went, can't remember what I was doing, but it was right after they had just paid millions of dollars for Rick Riley. And I was.
That's an amazing date and time.
It was fantastic. And I remember.
Why you would. I had it was a while ago, yeah.
I had a meeting with all of, this is years ago, with all of the brass. And I brought, I was like, they were talking about, they were, their question was, for me was, how do we make ESPN? We want to keep it cutting edge. We started out as this kind of, you know, badass outsiders. We're worried we're becoming part of the establishment. We're losing contact with younger sports fans. How do we be badass? And I just put it out. Well, one way to be badass is not to give millions of dollars to Rick Riley.
Oh, so they brought you in as this respected voice, like this observer, and they wanted to pick your brain. Oh, man, this must
They wanted to pick my brain.
Did and they have to pay you for this, by the way? They had to have paid you a little bit.
No, I came for fun. I just thought it'd be fun. I got invited. I was there just to visit with...
I can guess who invited you. Walsh. I could already... Yeah, absolutely.
Walsh. Walsh. Yeah. I love Walsh. And I've become friendly with him. And I went to see them. But I was like, that Rick Riley, to this day, the Rick Riley hire, like a guy who was so like, I mean, in his day was a great journalist. I loved him back in the day. But by the end, he just was so over sports. He just didn't want to be a sports writer anymore, right? You could just tell. He was like the movie critic. There's a certain point when in the movie critic's life when they just don't like the movies anymore. You can just tell. They're just not... They'd hate them all. It's just, I think Rick Riley wanted to do something else, but he was pigeonholed as a, and like.
You know what? I'm going to share a story with you too, because this was something as somebody who would talk, you know, I was talking more hours a week than almost anyone there. There was a handful of us, right? And you'd have to be a radio guy to even qualify for most hours talking in the air, but you get to a certain point and then every now and then a suit would bring you in. And sometimes you think you were catching up or expanding your own career and, you know, building this relationship. I spent a good 45 minutes being told why Rick Riley was the right hire when I didn't even bring it up. We just had time on the books. And by the way, good for Rick Riley. He got paid a ton. And yeah. I don't care about pretty much like anybody getting paid a lot. Like it should just raise all tides here. But I could tell that it was internally going over so poorly that he was almost like, you know, and again, there were more influential voices than me at ESPN. I'm not delusional, but it was almost like, let me, you know, we got Russillo's on the schedule this week. Let me sell him on this Rick Riley hire. And I was pitched that it basically, hey, for $15 million, we destroyed Sports Illustrated. And I was kind of like, I think the internet had a little bit to do with it too, though, no? It was just like, you dick, which what is why hilarious. I probably didn't do as well as I could have. But
what was hilarious was how much Rick Riley drove Simmons crazy. It was one of those things like, you know, there's certain things that just set him off. Like Riley, you even just use the initials RR around Simmons at that point in his life. And he would just like lose his shit. Cause absolutely, like, cause he was the future and Riley was the past and they were more interested in the past than the future. Like that was what was wrong with ESPN at that point.
That's also like a great reminder of the decision makers. You know, like I remember a friend telling me once, and it's one of my favorite lessons, is like the reason why you can cork wine and bring it home is that the people that vote on that stuff want to do it. You know, the selectmen in your town want to be able to cork a bottle of wine they haven't finished and bring it home. And that's why that law exists. And most people aren't going to give you a to-go cup when you leave a bar. Because those people aren't voting on that kind of stuff. And when you have the decision makers at that time at ESPN going, Rick Riley, fucking live Rick Riley, like read back page all the time, like done and done. I didn't know Bill that well back then. So I was not privy to those conversations. Oh, yeah.
Next time you're on a pod with Bill, just randomly drop, just say the words Rick Riley and see what happens. It's hilarious. It is hilarious. It's like if Bill was being interrogated by some hostile power and like they wanted to sort of torture him, they would just play. Remember Riley used to have that, just play tape of Rick Riley and Bill would be like, all right, I'll tell you everything. Just stop with Rick Riley.
I'm going to try to pull that off next time. I'll try to subtly slide it in there. Hey, congrats on the book. You know, I know how much work you put into this. I just want you to know how much those of us enjoy it and appreciate the work.
Oh, thank you.
So this was a lot of fun. I'm glad we finally got to do this.
Yeah. Thank you, Ryan.
This episode is brought to you by Arby's. I remember my first visit to Arby's. I went with my grandfather
fresh out of WWII. I reached for his hand. He declined my grasp. I was worried about the options. I said, I know they dominate the roast beef world, but is there going to be anything for me? And here's the thing. There is. Well, now is the chance to try Arby's and find your favorite sandwich. With a wide range of options, see for yourself that Arby's sells more than roast beef. Plus, for a limited time, Arby's Rewards members get one free sandwich with purchase every week in April, online only. Simply join Arby's Rewards and order ahead today. Order on the app or Arby's.com. Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
You want details? Bye. I drive a Ferrari 355 Cabriolet. What's up? I have a ridiculous house in the South Fork. I have every toy you can possibly imagine. And best of all, kids, I am liquid. So, now you know what's possible. Let me tell you what's required.
All right, it's everybody's favorite segment here, another edition of Life Advice. The email is lifeadvicerr@gmail.com. Okay. 6'3", 215. A fit but not Jack 205 before COVID, working or getting back. Not going to pretend I'm a 10, but not going to deny I'm probably an 8, 8.5 on a good day. Not that that's how I think. No, it's just the first thing you said in the fucking email. Just hard to convey attractiveness succinctly via email without a pic, which be, not sending pics via mail. Honestly, guys are sending pics nonstop now to this address, which is kind of funny. We promise we will not use those. Although Cerruti was thinking about just starting up a bunch of burner dating sites with guys that email the show. But I was like, let's not do that. I'm just kidding. That's not what I'm going to do. All right. Anyway, 43, good education, professional degree and job. Made good money from my late 20s until recently when I started questioning the crazy hours I work at a job I don't love. I'm not one of those follow your bliss types who thinks that everyone should be doing their dream job. Someone has to take out the trash and God bless them for it. But it matters to me that I do something I feel proud of beyond the money it pays. A couple months ago, I quit my job, budgeted for a year with a mix of savings, supplemental from part-time consulting, and take a time to get back into some things I enjoy that I used to be good at, like writing while catching up on reading. Putting together a plan for a consulting business. Is this me emailing? Putting together a consulting business. So the guy wants to open up a consulting business. The mix of what I used to do, plus some discount pro bono charitable work for causes. Companies I think deserve a leg up. If all goes well, I'll make 75% of what I made before, but working only 80% of the time and being 50% more satisfied. All right. So the guy's just banging out some ratios for us. At the same time, I'm reevaluating my personal life. Between college and my late 30s, I had 3 long-term relationships. 2 were about 3 years and 1 was 5 years, including 1 engagement that I broke off, and quite a few 6-weekers, as my friends and I call them, someone hot enough to keep your attention for 6 weeks, but not a long-term prospect. As I approached 40, I decided I was tired of the 6-weekers and wanted a long-term relationship, preferably leading to marriage. In retrospect, I wish I decided this 10 years earlier. I think what he's saying here, he's like, okay, in retrospect, I wish I had decided this 10 years earlier. Again, as you said, our guy here is 43. Shout out to the 30-year-olds who are enjoying playing the field and think there are no trade-offs. All right, a little stern there. Maybe he didn't say or, hey, think about, I don't know. There's a wording here I'm not figuring out. Because as of now, I'm caught in an awkward age position where if I want to have multiple children, I really need to meet a woman who is in her early 30s at the latest. Okay. Here's the math in my head. Even with a perfect sequence of events, if I meet someone today, I'd want to date for at least a year before I'd be ready to get engaged. I've learned from experience that anything less than that, you don't really know someone. Then say a year till the wedding, could be less, but let's say a year. And then another year to have a child, if it all goes smoothly, that's 3 years, give or take, at which point she and I will be each 3 years older. Yes, we follow. Add another 2 years for a second child and more for more children. Starting to feel like the Ben Stiller guy, the insurance risk guy. Add more years for more children. Not sure how many I like, but I'm one of 3 and that feels right, but we'll see.
I know that the miracles of modern science, women can have children into their early 40s, and obviously so can men, so they're increasing risk there too. But I also know far too many couples my age who put off marriage and children and have spent the years and tens of thousands of dollars trying, and the stress is damaged and broken the relationships, even if they're successful. They're usually only one child, and the health risks are not insignificant. My problem is I find dating a 30-year-old in my stage or my age strange. Obviously, some are super smart, worldly, and are more mature than me, but I still find it strange, and I'm self-conscious, especially when it comes to meeting and hanging out with their friends. The Steve Buscemi, "Hello, fellow kids" meme starts flashing in my head. So my question, do I just suck it up and accept that, or given the choices I made in my 30s, I just have to pretend to care about Taylor Swift and learn to speak emoji, or do I resign myself to the chance that I might not have the family I thought I would have and go out with women closer to my age, late 30s, who I like and usually find more all around attractive? Weird how that happens to you when you hit a certain age. Or do I get a dog and really lean into the emotionally distant but fun to hang out with and travel guy who knows the world and likes to share it on his terms, or deep down nurtures a pain he'll never talk about, which is who I'm gradually becoming unless I make one of these other choices? Appreciate any advice here, guy. I probably thought about some of these things. All right, here's the deal. I've definitely thought about all this stuff. I'm a thinker. You are hammering the thought process on this one to a point where you're kind of in your own head. All right, I'm going to share one. Like, this is before COVID, moved to Manhattan Beach, whatever. Guy invites me to this deal. I'm immediately the oldest guy there. I sized up that I was the oldest guy there. And guess who didn't have a very good time and had no chance, no prospects? Me, because I made a decision. Just like the story about me talking about how my dad would be like, hey, you lost the game on the ride over before we even got to the court. You will lose this game of pursuit of marriage and happiness and kids and family. You will lose this once you decide, like, you think about everything, man. There's like a lot of math in all this stuff, right? So it's, hey, here's my ratio of what I think I can do and how much I can make and what event, you know, what number I'll be proud of. Okay, so now let's talk about my long-term relationships. 3 years, 3 years, and 5 years. Now 6 weekers. Okay, so I wish I had decided I'd done this 10 years earlier. And look, I'll tell you, a lot of people that do have kids, almost every one of them says the only thing I wish I hadn't done was wait, which sucks. I don't even like saying that out loud. It stings a little, but it's true. So I'm not talking to Saruti directly, but I've heard it far more often. You know what I don't hear a ton of people saying? Is, man, I'm so psyched I had kids so much later. It's usually the other way around. So I feel for you on that one. But you have decided, like, as soon as you finish, you're clearly very smart and you think things out. But as soon as you start the sentence, you immediately counter that sentence. So it's like, hey, I could do this or this, but now here's all the problem. Again, I think it's a long cane poly, right? Ben Stiller's the risk management guy. I mean, this is what this reads like. So honestly, man, I think you're capable of pulling any of this stuff off. But, and I think you know that you're smart enough to know that you are making it harder on yourself than just kind of going with it. Because you know what's funny? About that time I went out to this deal in Manhattan Beach when I'd first shown up to town, and I turned to the guy that invited me and I was like, man, I'm so much fucking older than everybody here. And he was like, so? He's like, welcome to California. And I was like, yeah, I don't know. I'm just kind of like, this is pretty young, dude. He's like, who gives a shit? He's like, you don't have to say how old you are. And I was like, yeah, but I wouldn't want to be like a lie about my age guy. And the thing was, is he never thinks about any of this stuff. This guy that invited me to the thing, he's like, yeah, I'm older too. Whatever. Like, it's on. Let's go. Let's have a great time. And I'm thinking like, yeah, but why? So when you already have all these kind of mental hangups, like, you make it that much harder on yourself. Like, why can't you meet somebody who's 36 and have kids? I mean, yeah, you can bring up risks health-wise. I don't know what the numbers are, but is it so overwhelming that you're going out every night being like, okay, I can only factor in 30-year-olds because then by kid number 3, she's 36 and we're still in a safe window? I mean, this is a lot of overthinking. And honestly, this email, the way you present it, the overthinking is fucking you up as much as anything else is. It just is. And the only reason I know that is because I can do this kind of stuff too. Not to this level where I have all these alternative paths mapped out and then I start to shoot down why every one of these paths also can't work. So I'd say the first thing you need to do is fucking relax. Just relax. All right. And I know that's easy to say. Because when you want a family, and it sounds like you really want a family, and look, like, at least you're a guy in this scenario. And imagine, you know, and how much more women have to deal with the timeline of stuff and how much that sucks for them compared to how much it sucks for us. It's way worse for them. So I'm not going to give you any, I'm not going to say, yeah, give me option B. I'm going to tell you, you've got to relax, because actually I think it's going to be harder to get this right with all of this going on in your head. All right. Cause you're going to meet that 30-year-old and you're going to go like, oh my God, she's got that one friend that's so annoying. And she talks about Taylor Swift. Oh, okay. So now what am I going to do? Oh, I met this 37-year-old. Okay. But when I map it up, you're kid 3, 6 years, she's 40, you know, like, I mean, imagine thinking about that stuff when you're ever meeting somebody who you could potentially spend some time with. And it seems like women do like you, right? It seems like women like you. It seems like you have a lot of options. So that's great. You gave yourself an 8.5. So be happy about the options. Be happy that you're not a guy emailing going, no one likes me ever. And I'm only going to have a dog, you know? And that sucks. Think about that guy. How much it sucks for that guy who has none of the options that you say that you have. So feel better about that. Have a more open-minded attitude about this whole process and relax. Kyle?
Yeah, I mean, I've kind of stepped away from the thing where I'm like, I'm too young to be giving life advice to anybody. But I'm going to just say, I'm going to say partly that and partly like, can you do like a straight up real dating site where there's like women that want families? Like, I don't know. I mean, maybe it seems a little eerie, but like a straight up, like respected, like, you know, what is it? eHarmony, or like with the old white guy with the white hair, that's eHarmony. He just seems like he brings people together. And I'm just wondering, like, I think that's the guy. I haven't seen those commercials in a long time, but he's got glasses. Wait, so in the suit.
Because the eHarmony commercial host seems trustworthy and old, you feel like he's got his priorities. He has our like, priorities, right?
It seems like Hitch. He seems like Hitch to me. You know what I mean? The Will Smith movie. It seems like he knows what's right for all of us. So I just think that maybe you could give that a whirl and like just look at women who are, you know, in your age range, because you're such a fucking numbers guy, and just see if they're like interested in families now. And I think, you know, maybe that would work. Have you tried that? If you're going to spend all your time, because if you're thinking just, you have to meet the person and then you have to spend a year before you know if you want to get married, and you're already mapped out into your second kid, you kind of don't have a ton of time. So, you know, and the older you get, the more weird it's going to seem to you that they're younger. So maybe try, like, you know, putting your specifications in eHarmony. I don't know.
Analytics. There you go.
That one surprised me, Kyle. I did not expect an eHarmony. That you're hypnotized by the old guy that hosts the eHarmony commercials.
Just seems like a great guy.
I mean, he's 43. He's not 53. Like, I don't know. I've already said whatever I was going to say. So go ahead, Srudy.
No, I would be kind of worried, because if this guy, if he's like, okay, I want to date young 30-year-olds, right? Girls in their early 30s, just because I want to have a family. Like, are you actually going to be finding someone that you want to be with? Or are you just checking off something on your list so that you can have a family? And then that's going to come back and potentially bite you in the ass later in life if you don't actually like the person you're with. And then the other problem is, if you end up not dating someone, or dating someone who's older, right, who's more close to your age, and you can't have kids, at least on your own, you know, there's always the adoption option. Are you going to hold that against, like, there's always like a problem that you're pointing out with someone. Why don't you just let your life play out the way it's supposed to play out, you know? And if that includes getting a dog at some point in your life and you're just kind of solo, then that's cool too. But I think with you putting all these expectations on what you have to do and what you should do, that might not even lead you to happiness. That's the irony in this whole situation. You know what I mean? So I would say, you know, if you really want, because he seems open to all three of those options, even though he does want a family. But why can't you just see what's out there for you? If you meet a cool girl that's 32, that's great. If you meet a girl that's 40, that's great. And just see what happens in the next couple of years. Don't have such a stringent plan on it.
Yeah, I mean, this sounds so simple, but like, how about the next person you really like, you just see where it goes?
Yeah. And I know, he's worried about then, you know, the marriage, kids thing, and he's worried about the timetable, but just, I don't know, be happy. Try to be happy. That's first and foremost what's the most important thing.
I think BS Pod had a promo code for eHarmony, by the way, now that I'm remembering. Okay. Think BS, promo code BS. I don't know if it's still active.
Okay, then good. Then I think we nailed it.
Is that true?
That seems like a bad promo code.
I think they made me sign up a long time ago. They made me sign up.
Somebody tried to get me to do that at ESPN. You remember that, Cerruti?
Yeah. Yep. On eHarmony specifically, though, I remember it was some sort of app or whatever. I don't know.
I don't remember which one it was. They were like, hey, would you do this in a live read and then share your experience? I was like, no. That's not going to happen. That might have been one of the few live reads I was going to turn down because you should get paid for those. P90X was giving us $5,000 a month.
Yeah, Gottlieb. I remember that.
That was unbelievable.
Do you remember the Chrysler Pacifica minivan one that they pitched to you and Cannell? And it was just like so not on brand for the show. It was like, you know, lug your family around in this thing. And it's like you doing reads for a minivan.
Yeah, because they were trying to get us a van. Like there was some deal where they were going to get us a van for a year and we were going to have it. And that was going to be part of like this big rollout. And it was unbelievable how little thought they had put into it.
No.
Because I was like the only guy without a family. Yeah. And I was going to be the minivan guy. The P90X thing, just so people understand, that is not normal. It was an absurd amount of money and they were paying every host. That's why every one of us were pitching P90X because it was an off the charts amount of money. I ended up saving for a down payment on my condo from P90X. And the only reason I got it is Van Pelt turned it down. And Van Pelt was like, what are you getting? I was like, yeah, it's like $5,000 a month. This is like everybody's on it right now. He's like, what are you doing? I go, I work out enough that I can incorporate a little bit in there, you know? Gottlieb went crazy. Gottlieb like went full blown, lost a ton of weight, super ripped up, started telling me how he was putting like just vinegar on his salads, like no olive oil, just vinegar. And he took it to another level. And then he sent me a picture of him with his shirt off. And he's like, I know this is kind of weird, but I just want you to see this. And I was like, you know what? It is weird, but you are ripped up right now. So
he kind of looks like that Tony Horton guy, you know, right? That's his name, right? Tony Horton was the P90X guy. He's in all his commercials. Am I making
was
that
it?
Up?
I thought I Tony so. Horton was the guy that was on the elliptical that had like a little bit of a ponytail.
Man, that could be it too. Hold on.
No, yeah, let's get research on this.
No, right. Tony Horton, yeah, P90X. He's
oh, he is
three now. It looks good. Yeah,
he that does. Looks like Gottlieb. Good. All right, so wait, who was the? I feel like the other guy was a Tony though. Give me long hair, blonde ponytail, fitness guy. Was he a Tony as well?
That Look, was an elliptical, right?
Yeah, I'm a former P90X guy, so I should have known. The funny thing is I set my before pictures. I had to take my shirt off and my girlfriend at the time took pictures of me with my shirt off and I was pumped because the P90X guy was like, Jesus.
He's like, Tony Little.
Tony Little. See?
There it is.
About the Tonys.
He's 63. They're the same age. He and Tony Horton are the same age. That's wild.
Maybe they are the same guy.
Yeah. Just one with a wig.
All right. Okay. Here we go. What's up? 6'1", 195, shredded. Guys are really, really ticking it up a notch here.
He's doing P90X.
Yeah. My wife and I recently booked a trip to Denver where we hung out with a friend who's in real estate finance. Our conversation led to another with a friend. We started seriously considering buying a house. We currently live in Michigan. It won't be in Denver for another 1.5 to 2 years while I finish up grad school. So we were banking on being able to rent out the house until we're living in Denver full time. So you're looking at buying a house in Denver in 2021. Have fun with that. One of my friends, his appraisal is double what it was in 2018. 3 years ago. 3 years ago. It's double. Okay, so we got pre-approved for our home loan because my wife has a good paying and steady job, but all the money for our cash down payment is going to come from some savings and other assets that I've been fortunate enough to accrue over the years. As we progress through the house hunting process, I've become less enthusiastic about using up these assets. Coming into grad school, I was planning to use these assets to minimize the amount of debt I take on or perhaps entirely avoid taking on debt if a few things fall into place. Look, some people have a really hard time with taking on debt. For whatever reason, mortgage debt doesn't seem to count as real debt. I know that's kind of how, you know, I've looked at some transactions in the past. It's up to you. Some people just see this number that's outstanding and they lose their fucking mind over it. And then other people just say, hey, this is how business is done. And that number is not even a real number anyway. It's not like I'm ever going to be writing a check for all of that because I'm going to be buying another house at some point anyway. So, you know, why would I even get bogged down with that? All right. So people look at debt differently. And that's very, very true as I, you know, experienced kind of how people look at it. All right. So coming into grad school, I was planning to use these assets to minimize the amount of debt I take on, perhaps entirely avoiding taking on debt. A few things fall into place. A financial advisor could do better than I could on telling you like, okay, well, if you're talking about college loans, the interest on the long-term payout is probably so low that you don't want to just go, hey, I'm now debt free. You'd have to look at I'd have to know exactly what the math is on paying it out long term or paying down the college debt immediately. But I would rather have cash on hand than just pay down college loans. I just would. And you're still going to get approved for stuff with college loans out there. You know, when you have college loans or you have a mortgage, that debt is looked at differently than some asshole maxing out his credit card all the time and doing the minimum payment with a $20,000 balance.
Ouch.
So those are different ways that banks are going to look at you. I know that buying a home can be like trading one asset for another, but I'm a pretty debt averse person. There you go. Consider myself more responsible with money than my wife. She's admitted to and agreed with me on. I'm starting to lose my appetite for the risk. My wife is pretty determined to buy a house because prices, especially in Denver, continue to rise. She argues that we'll end up spending more 2 years from now if we wait, which I think is a fair point. Given my circumstances, what would you do? Am I foolish for wanting to cash out stock savings to avoid on taking on debt that we very likely can afford? To pay off later? Is it better to minimize my school loan debt in this instance, given we'd be taking out a sizable loan for the house? The only other debt we have as a couple is a loan for my wife's car that should be paid off in the next 3 years. All right. The fact that you ended it with like the only other debt that we have is the car loan that should be paid off. You are clearly very responsible. You probably, and this isn't even a negative, but like you almost sound like prudent about it. I'm not saying you're cheapering like that, but I could just tell. All right. Cause I started answering. Honestly, I should have just read the whole email all the way through, but some of the stuff I could tell. So back to the college loan thing, we've already covered that. The car loan thing, whatever. You don't really have, I think banks look at it as like bad debt, understandable debt. You know, this, you don't seem to have any of that bad debt. Now the real thing, I'm not even worried about the debt thing as much as I'm worried about the Denver pricing thing. I mean, and by the way, that's what every fucking realtor says to you, all right? Like, hey, if you don't buy now, I mean, realtors not in the habit of telling people to not buy houses. Think about it, right? Like, imagine if you ran into a car salesman. It's like, you know what? I'd wait until the fall. It's never going to happen. Never going to happen. Realtors are always going to tell you stuff like this because that's a job. And I know people think it's like an anti-realtor state. It's just the truth. It's just the truth. So I personally, you look at a market like Denver and you go, now I'm going to buy. And I've been at the top of markets and bought, and I've been where I thought I was at the top and I wasn't at the top. You know, I've sold in Connecticut where it felt like it took forever just to be like even again. So to sit there and have anyone, certainly me as like a podcast host, to tell you, oh, now's the time to buy or don't buy now. I'm just telling you, Denver has been on fire in a way that no one would ever have predicted. I think COVID has, as we've talked about at other times, COVID has motivated people to move more for a lifestyle, which I don't know how that's even remotely a permanent possibility now for how everybody's just going to, like Denver's a sustainable city. Denver's always going to be fine. But some of these other cities that have blown up, I'm like, people are just going to live there now the rest of their lives? That doesn't seem to make a ton of sense. For me to say that there's some market real estate correction coming, it's coming. I don't know when it's coming. I don't know how these prices are sustainable. But then you have to start playing the game of like trying to middle it. And I'm not smart enough to figure that out. You probably aren't either. You know? So the scary thing is you're buying in a market that has just been absolutely on fire. And, you know, it's one thing to take on debt. That's the mortgage, you know, the loan on the mortgage versus the down payment. But it's a whole nother deal when all of a sudden your house is worth like 30% less than when you bought it. And it's not just debt, but now you're like, wait, like I look at this payoff number I have and now look at the new appraisal. And that turns into a whole nother deal that just sucks. Like every one of my friends, the first housing crisis going back to pre-2008, it was right around, you know, most of my friends were early 30s. They were buying their first homes. And I had a ton of friends that were just wiped out. All the equity wiped out because everybody was approved for housing. And so the housing thing was out of control. Did it mean it derailed their lives and their destitute afterwards? No. Like there are going to be things that turn into good investments. There are going to be things that fuck you up a little bit. And it didn't mean that anybody, I didn't meet any, none of my friends turned into like, hey, it was never the same for them after that. But a lot of them went through it because they were buying at that time. So I probably scared you here a little bit, but the only way you can play it is you can buy now and hope it keeps going up, but you maybe even does for a couple of years. But then what? Are you going to know when to sell? Like, that's hard. Or you could rent, and you could rent knowing I'm going to rent hoping to strike when things dip. But if you have a wife that's like really down with trying to buy something now, that's a whole nother challenge. Because I think people like security. Like, they like the idea. Like, I don't love the idea of rent and paying somebody else's mortgage, but I like it a hell of a lot better than buying a house that might be worth 30% less, because it seems like everybody's moving to Denver right now. So she's probably not going to go for that. And my rent thing for 2 years, ride it out, see if there's a correction on the price. What if the correction happens in 4 years, you know? And then you spent rent for 2 years while the prices went up again, and you're going to think this advice sucks. So I don't have a clear path for you. I just know that some of these markets scare the shit out of me, and Denver will be one of them. I hope you feel better, because there's no way you do after that answer. And I'm sorry for that, but there you go.
I would say, so my wife's a realtor. She mostly does commercial, but does do some residential too. And you know,
must be nice.
No, she's killing it. So shouts out to Maddie. But I think unless you have to buy in this market, I don't think she would recommend that you buy a house in this market. Like, some people are just like, hey, I want to move and this is where I want to live. That's great. And that's cool. And they don't really care about the prices and they're going to just live their lives. But Ryan, you probably would know more about this than I would too, though. But you know, if it's a long term real estate investment, like, no one in the last 100 years has really taken a loss buying property, correct? Like, it always goes up at some point. So if you're trying to, like, in 3 years sell and move, yeah, you may take a loss. But if this is some sort of long term housing arrangement for you, you're going to be fine.
Yes, but I mean, that was kind of the primary argument prior to the housing crisis, that everybody's like, well, housing just goes up. And it's like, why? Like, well, just because it goes up.
But it went up. It's up again now, though. Like, there was a housing crisis, and I know that was shitty. Obviously, I'm not trying to, like,
there's some areas though that, you know, were just
but chances are Denver's a place you want to be. So it's never
Denver's like, yeah, Denver has, yeah, I wouldn't compare Denver to like North Florida.
Exactly. So yes. Right. So I don't know. I think, you know, it depends on how long you want to be there, but I don't think investing in that has ever really historically been in America a bad decision.
Actually, Cerruti, it's a great point. And it shows your real estate background and the access that you have to that kind of stuff. Because you're right. If you're going to be there, like, how long are you going to be there? You want to live there for 10 years? All right. Well, now we're talking about something different. And I should have brought that up, but I'm more short term all the time now. And, you know, most people are normal and moving into a house and hoping to live there 10 plus years and raise a family. And maybe they live in the house for 20 years. You know, I don't know. I'm just saying the entry point into it right now doesn't feel great. And when everybody keeps doing this shit where it's like, well, you got to buy now because the prices are going to keep going up. And you're like, well, that's not like we just did it 13 years ago, where that's why everybody started buying like crazy again. Another reason was everybody was freaked out about how the prices kept going up, and they were all told over and over again, like, oh, the price is just going to keep going up. They're going to keep going up. There's some really alarming trends on home prices that are way beyond what we went through before. And I don't have the answers to it, so I'm not going to pretend to. I'm just telling you there are numbers that should scare the shit out of you. And I don't know. But everybody back then was like, oh, don't worry about it. Doesn't mean anything. Always goes up.
Tell me this is a stupid thought process, though, but this is what I always thought. If there's ever a situation in this country where the housing, where like houses or the properties, you know, is worth nothing, or it just completely crashes, we probably have bigger problems in this country than just the housing market, correct? Like, there's probably something fundamentally wrong with the country. So as long as like America is what it is, I kind of always feel like at some point over a 20-year period, whatever you invest in real estate wise is probably going to hold its value or go up.
Yeah, I think it also is like different. I think we grew up with generations prior to us where the idea was you save, you get the down payment, you do the 30-year, you pay it off, and then that's your retirement. Boom, there you go. We're more transactional. There are different products all over the place. I mean, we could get to something else, but I mean, this is now a bigger picture economic thing where there's all sorts of stuff I can read that I'll be like, oh, that's scary. That doesn't seem cool. Like, how come we can just keep doing stimulus over and over and over again? Like, we're just fine. And then you'll read something else and be like, yeah, we're fine. You're like, I don't know. I simply present it as being aware of both sides of the argument, but there's certain markets with housing where they're so beyond the crisis numbers on pricing that I don't think it's ridiculous to ask, like, hey, so this is just going to be cool this time around. Like, yeah. we're just cool. Like, there's no, I mean, there will be a correction. I don't know that it would be what we went through, but I don't know how you couldn't go through 2008, 2009 and be a little spooked by stuff. And that's all I'm saying.
That's so fair.
Yeah. All right, Kyle, you want to jump in on that one? Probably not, huh?
Yeah, I mean, not really. I don't have much to say about that other than I'd like to start buying a house in the next 3 to 4 years, and you shot me right through the heart with your credit card statement. But that's it.
Yeah, we'll pay that shit off. Don't do the minimum payment.
Ouch.
All right.
Now I feel like I actually bumped Kyle out too much, and for that I apologize. I don't even know. Now it's just awkward. I don't know what to do now. All right, Kyle.
Yeah, me neither. I don't know what to do either. How do you think I feel? I'm kidding. I'm selling my stocks to pay my credit cards.
All right. There you go. A little financial advice from Kyle as well on the way out. And thanks to Cerruti. And be sure to check out the Ryan Russillo podcast and subscribe, part of Spotify and The Ringer.